Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
And welcome to the Howard Eskin podcast. This would be episode number 7. Just rolling along, just trying to hopefully you're entertained. Hopefully that the people that I get on the podcast are interesting to you. And hopefully the things that I say are interesting to you as well. So podcast episode number 7, which you can get on iTunes easily enough, and you can subscribe. So when the new one comes up, it will notify you that there is a new podcast up. And this week, by the way, hopefully you enjoyed last week's podcast with Michael Vick. Some interesting things, an interesting future, could be an interesting future for Michael Vick, and it could be back in football, not necessarily that flag football nonsense. I don't know how he's going to play recovering from the surgery on his ankle. And it broke a while ago. He just had to have it. It was giving him problems. But who knows? He may end up working at some point for Andy Reid and the Kansas City Chiefs. But this week, the Super Bowl losing quarterback, who should have been the Super Bowl winning quarterback, and that would be Matt Ryan. And I have stated this before, and I will say it again. The New England Patriots did not win the last Super Bowl. The Atlanta Falcons lost the last Super Bowl. I don't know that you can blame it on the quarterback, because if his offensive coordinator had done, we talk about it when I talk to Matt Ryan. This is a game that Atlanta should have won and New England should not have won. That's two Super Bowls in their five where the other team lost it and they didn't win it. So, and I'm sticking to that, and I'm not changing that, and that's my final answer. But Matt Ryan says some interesting things. We talk about the game. We talk about Carson Wentz. We talk about how tough it is for rookies to come into the league. We talk about all those things. So let's now hear from the Super Bowl, the Atlanta Falcons Super Bowl almost winning quarterback, should have won quarterback, and that would be Matt Ryan. All right, I'm here with Matt Ryan, who should have been the Super Bowl winning quarterback, as in my mind. Oh my gosh, I was rooting so hard against the Patriots and rooting for you. Matt, I think about that game a lot, but I'm not you. How much do you think back to that?
Yeah, I mean, you think about it. Certainly, you know, in the immediate aftermath, it was tough. I mean, that loss stung for sure. You know, kind of following the game, the days following the game, I got back and watched it, went through the tape, and the first time through is emotional for sure, because the scars and the wounds are still fresh. But as I got through it once or twice, you know, you start to, you know, be critical of what we were doing, and you try and go through the same normal routine mm-hmm. that you go through all year, so you can be better the next time we get there. But I find myself, you know, at different times through the offseason as we get into our workouts, thinking about that and trying to use it as motivation, being hungrier than we were last year.
You know, are there plays where every once in a while when you drift back to that, you start thinking about?
I think so. I mean, I think we did so many good things as a team.
Sure did,
yeah, as a team and as individuals, we did a lot of really good things throughout that game. And I'm proud of the way that we showed up. We competed and played pretty well. But, you know, we had some opportunities, you know, in the fourth quarter to make some plays that we didn't make. And to me, that's the thing that you think about, whether it's a sack late in a game, which hurt, or, you know, an opportunity just to be on top of details collectively. You know, could we have been a little bit better in that regard? Maybe that would have been the thing that got us over the end. And I think, you know, that's the area where we've been better this offseason is the attention to detail, understanding that you have to be on top of it 12 months a year. I think that's been really a really good learning lesson for us.
Two situations come back to me. The onside kick, which I think Bill Belichick, this genius, did it too early. You guys get it. All you need is maybe 10 yards to kick a field goal. And then the one that just drives me crazy, What a great pass to Julio Jones. What a great catch. I mean, impossible to defend. You're on the 21, and I'm thinking, all right, the run three plays, kick a field goal, the game's over.
Right.
Like, when the play comes in, what are you thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things. As a player, when you're playing, you're just going, all right, the call's in. Let's make sure we execute it the best right. we can. You know, in hindsight, I think looking back on it, would we have done anything differently? Of course we would have. You know, we wanted a different result. You know, but as a player, I think when you're in those situations, you think about just making plays that, you know, making the best of the play that comes in. You know, maybe we could have done things a little bit differently. But, you know, it is what it is. I think the drive before that, you know, you talk about we get the onside kick, we have an opportunity, and we get the sack fumble. Which they then go on and score. I mean, that's a play to me that, you know, we can be detailed a little bit better in that situation as well. So a few things here and there at the end of the game that were disappointing and hurt. You know, but I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic about our guys and bouncing back and using it as motivation.
You know, you say a lot of we, which is what a teammate and a quarterback especially has to do. How important is that to kind of keep it together? I mean, obviously you're not going to comment it. I blame the offensive coordinator for not running the ball three times. But you're a team, and how important it is for you, how important is it for you, the quarterback, to kind of stay in that team we mode?
I think it's critical. You know, I think what we've tried to build in our building and our organization is a culture of brotherhood. That's what we talk about all the time. And to me, you know, it was evident after that game because I think when situations get tough, and you know, things don't go the way you want them to, it's very easy to splinter and to point fingers. And one of the things I'm most proud of is the way that our guys responded, had each other's backs throughout the entire organization from the top to the bottom. We were all pissed. I mean, there's no getting around that. We were all frustrated with how it went down. But, you know, we were tighter than that. And we weren't going to even let something like that kind of split us up. And I think that's going to serve us well in the future.
When you think back, and coaches will tell you all the time, you guys may never get back here again, so give it everything you got. Do you worry about that, that you might never get back there again?
Well, you know, I think that's, you never know. Like,
right.
In life, you know, nothing's certain. And that's why you want to take advantage of every opportunity that you have. And that's why it stings so much when it doesn't go the way that you want it to. Because you know, I've played in the league 9 years now. I know how difficult it is and how many things have to go right to be able to get that opportunity. But at the same time, I'm very optimistic and very confident in the people that we have in our building. And that kind of makes me think that, you know what, we've set a standard for ourselves of what we're capable of doing. We have a blueprint for what we need to do throughout the year to get us to that point. And I think we also know what it takes to win that game. We were very close. And so I'm excited about the blueprint that we have.
You know, in Philadelphia, the quarterback, well, in every team, the quarterback's essential. I mean, that's the key to a team. And obviously the people in Philadelphia have high hopes for Carson Wentz. I don't know how much you saw him in the game you played because obviously you're worried about getting yourself taken care of when you're on the sidelines, but you've probably seen a bunch of them. Your impressions of Carson Wentz after 1 year?
Well, I thought he did a good job. I thought he had a good season. It's tough. I mean, it is tough to come in and play right away. I had to do it, and I know how difficult that can be. I always felt like he was very composed, you know, throughout the year. Good things happen for sure. Bad things happen. That's the case with everybody, specifically in your rookie season. But he felt like he stayed even keeled throughout the year, and I think that's a trait that's going to serve him well. He's got all the skills. You know, he's big, he's strong, he's accurate, he throws the ball well. I know Justin Peele, who's a coach for the Eagles. I played with him in Atlanta. I know he really, you know, he loves him and, you know, says he has the right stuff to be a great competitor in this league.
You know as well as anybody, body language is something that maybe players can feed off in a bad way if it's bad body language. The one thing I've noticed about Carson, when there's a bad play, he's back there just looking at the pictures, doing what he has to do. But the body language is okay. Okay, let's move on. How important that is that for, especially a young player?
I think it's huge. I mean, body language is everything. To me, you know, your guys around you are feeding off of everything that you do, whether it's what you say, whether it's how you act, whether it's your body language, whatever it is. And I think having that consistent, you know, confident body language, regardless of what's going on out there, being under control, you know, making guys believe that you have things under control, I think that's critical.
How tough is it for rookies to come in the league? The draft just happened. Everybody counts. Oh, this guy did this in college. But how tough is it? Probably more so for a quarterback, but for a player.
Well, I think it's, you know, the football part of it is hard enough. I mean, that's one of the things that's difficult. That transition's really tough. Everything else that goes along with it, that change from college to the NFL is a lot. I mean, there's just a lot of things that are thrown at you, a lot of things that you've never really had to take care of before in your life. And so there's a lot of extra stuff that comes along with it. I think if you can learn to manage that, it helps your on-field. But it's tough for guys right now to come in and play right away.
I talked to Michael Vick this week, and people don't understand the transformation he made as a human being. And you've had some, obviously, interactions with him. Your thoughts on Michael Vick and how he's changed his life?
Well, you know, I didn't know Mike, you know, prior to getting to Atlanta and when, you know, things went south for him in Atlanta. But I've known him since. And the Mike that I've known since has been a great guy. He is supportive of me. He's been incredibly helpful throughout my career. He definitely understands, you know, my role of being the quarterback of the Atlanta Falcons as well as anybody on the planet.
Right.
And he's been very helpful for that. But I also think he's been such a positive role model, you know, for people that you make a mistake. And he did, and you know, he paid for it. There's no question about that. He served his time, and he's come back out and become an advocate and really a good mentor for a lot of young guys.
Did he talk football stuff with you? Did you learn anything from him from a football standpoint?
Yeah, some things football. I mean, I saw him probably 6 weeks ago. We played golf. He was down. He was in a cast, so he didn't play, but he was down for a golf
right.
event. I was out with Arthur Blank. And we got to spend some time together. And just talking about ball there, we've played with similar players. So Matt Schaub, who is currently my backup, was his backup in Atlanta. So, I mean, there's a lot of guys that we know, a lot of ball that's been played that we've talked about. And I always enjoy, you know, spending time with Mike.
Well, I heard you played at Augusta. Now, obviously, playing with you last year in your tournament, I see how good a player you are.
Someday.
But what did Augusta do to you?
I'll beat you up. There's no question about it. It's such a great place, and I've been lucky to, you know, have played over there. But that golf course is, you know, around the greens, if you're not sharp, it'll eat your lunch. And so I enjoyed it, had a great time, but the course won.
Well, Matt, I'm rooting for you. As always, I'm rooting for you. As long as both you and the Eagles get in the playoffs, because it's more fun for me if they win, too.
I hear you.
Thanks, Matt.
Howard.
Thank you. All right, obviously, Matt Ryan does think a lot of Carson Wentz. Maybe he can see some of the same things in Carson Wentz that he saw in him himself. But I'll say it again. If Kyle Shanahan had run the ball after that pass by Matt Ryan to Julio Jones and it got them to the 21-yard line of New England, run three plays, kick the field goal, the game's over. Can't change that now. I'm not sure Matt Ryan will get back, but I appreciate Matt Ryan, but he wouldn't throw anybody from the team, especially the coach, and that was the only one that I would throw under the bus. By the way, it was fun. His family and he are connected with an organization which is for kids, BelieveInAchieveFoundation.org. And he's got a golf tournament coming up, which I played in last year, which was a lot of fun, at a really nice golf course outside Philadelphia, and that's on June 19th. All right, in terms of football, in terms of Carson Wentz, in terms of the Eagles, as this podcast is being put together for you, Fletcher Cox, Jason Peters, and Donnie Jones did not report to the OTAs, which is voluntary. Carson Wentz was there. Can you tell anything from the OTAs? Yeah, I can tell Alshon Jeffrey can catch. I can call when there's really no defenders against, and there are defenders, but they're really not tough defense against Nelson Aguilar, who changed his number. He's now number 13. 17 is Alshon Jeffrey. But he can catch the ball now. And when you watch these OTAs, which I have watched, it looks like everybody can play. The offensive line is a little disadvantaged. Jason Kelce was talking about trying to get back to where he was the second half of last season, where he was years ago, and I still believe that he will be with the team. But let's get back to Fletcher Cox, Jason Peters, and Donnie Jones. Donnie Jones, I don't get it, unless he's got some family things that he wanted to do. He knows he can punt. He knows he doesn't have to be there. John Dornbos came off a couple of surgeries in the offseason, was there, and he's got to try to make sure that everything's okay with his wrist, which he had a couple of, at least two surgeries on, but he looked fine in snapping the football. But Fletcher Cox is arguably the best player on defense. I don't know you have to argue that much. You could say Jordan Hicks had a better year. But Fletcher Cox should be there. I know it's voluntary. If you ask the coaches, hey, listen, I don't want to go through all the reps. Can I just go through some of the reps and take a couple days off? But just to show up on the first day and to come, as it was when we put this podcast together, he was not there. He's supposed to be a leader. Fletcher Cox, is it going to change anything? Is it going to hurt anything? No, probably not. Probably not. But he should have been there just to show that he's the leader of that defensive line. And all that nonsense about Brandon Graham, that was just total nonsense, total BS. And Brandon Graham was there, practiced hard. He will continue to do so. And he never had any intention of not showing up. But as he said, hey, listen, everybody wants more money. But that was not what he was thinking about. And he knows that he should be there. And so should Fletcher Cox, who already got his money. Jason Peters, the leader on the offensive line. And I understand that he's 35 years old. And I understand that Jason Peters has to save his body. Well, all he does, all he has to do is tell the coaches, hey, listen, coach, I just... hopefully I don't have to go through as much. I want to try to save it for the season. I want to try to save it for training camp, which they run through practice, but they don't play much in the game. And he should be there if he wants to show that he is the leader of the offensive line. He absolutely, positively should be there. There's no question he should be there. All right, an interesting, and I want to talk about the Phillies. I want to talk, there's an interesting situation concerning Pete Rose, which I think is absolutely nauseating and ridiculous by Major League Baseball. But we'll do that. Chip Carey, if you don't know, is the play-by-play television announcer for the Atlanta Braves. His father was a play-by-play announcer, but his grandfather, Harry Carey, and by the way, Chip Carey is Harry Carey III, his grandfather is Harry Carey, legendary. For those people that don't know Harry Carey, you can go to YouTube. I couldn't use it on this podcast, was not permitted by rights and all his other kind of, that other kind of nonsense. But Harry Carey is legendary as a play-by-play baseball announcer, worked in Chicago, and people remember him with the Chicago Cubs. Totally, absolutely legendary. But a fascinating story, which I didn't even know. I had no clue what the story was until I talked to Chip Carey, and I am fascinated by the story. You, I'm sure, will be fascinated by Chip Carey, who obviously very successful in the play-by-play field of baseball. He's done other things. At times he does playoffs for Major League Baseball. You may have heard him. May have heard him with the Braves if you've heard the Braves games. But a fascinating story concerning his grandfather, the legendary Harry Carey. Here's Chip Carey.
All right, genius, you have been in baseball a long time. It goes back to your grandfather.
Yeah.
Okay, is that what got you started to either loving the game or doing what you wanted to do?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, every kid pretty much wants to do what their dad did. Fortunately or unfortunately for me, I had two examples of my dad and my grandfather, but I didn't know them very well. My grandparents divorced when I was really little. My parents divorced when I was really little as well. And so I didn't really spend time with either my dad or my grandfather. And like most people who grew up in the 80s, when cable TV started moving west into the suburbs in St. Louis where I grew up, that's how I kept track. I'd be like every kid. I'd come home from school, turn on the Cubs game, see this crazy old man with glasses sing, take me out to the ball game, go to baseball practice, finish my homework, have dinner, and then watch the Braves play the Giants on TBS on the West Coast. So my relationship with my dad and grandfather as a teenager was like most fans. And then I started thinking, well, wow, what a cool way to maybe make a living. I wasn't good enough to play. And I thought, well, if they can do it, I think I could maybe try to do this. And that's that's kind of how the seed started for me as a high school junior in the suburbs of St. Louis.
You know, that's really interesting, because you would have figured you would have hung around with your grandfather, Harry Carey, and that would have kind of grown the desire inside, but that's totally opposite from what happened.
Well, yeah, I mean, most people think that, at least as far as I'm concerned, I was born with a silver microphone in my right hand, and that wasn't the case at all. I mean, I've told the story before. When I was a kid in St. Louis, my grandfather had remarried. His widow, Dutchie, had four children, and one of her sons went to my high school, played on my baseball team. And we both played baseball, Little League baseball or Legion baseball, at the same field. And we had finished our game, and some friends of mine said, "Hey, your grandfather's here." I said, "Oh, okay, great, I'll go say hi." So I walked by and waved to him. He didn't know who I was. And obviously I was crushed by that. I didn't blame him. That's just the way that life was for our family. And so when I got into the business, getting out of college at Georgia and became the Magic's TV announcer, I think that sort of kindled a commonality between the two of us. He had something that he could relate with me besides my name. I'm Harry Christopher Carey III. But there was a person behind it. There was a career and a family behind that. And over time, from when I was about 23, 24 years old, he and I started to connect on a couple of levels. And unfortunately, we didn't get to connect ultimately by working together with the Cubs, because that was the ultimate plan.
You know what? Myself, as you know, and my son are in the same business. We're not on the air together, but he was, and people make those connections. How tough was it for you to be a broadcaster with the Cubs when Harry Carey was such a legend?
Well, he died. I mean, he was...
I know that, but still, you followed somewhere... not followed, but yeah.
No, I understand. I mean, I'll answer it this way. Tommy Brenneman had the apprenticeship. Tommy was doing the Cubs games on radio and TV and was doing the games with Harry at the time, and then he moved on to the Diamondbacks. Josh Lewin had a chance to work there. I mean, all of those guys got the benefit of that fantastic baseball encyclopedia knowledge of what it was like to see Jackie Robinson's first game, Stan Musial's rookie year, baseball in the train era, and expansion west to the West Coast for the Dodgers and the Giants. I didn't have that. And obviously in our world today, you know, the old nepotism word gets thrown around an awful lot.
I
make no apologies for the fact that I've had a lot of advantages that other people don't, but stepping into that chair was an almost impossible task. No one was going to replace Jack Brickhouse or Harry Carey in the TV booth of the Chicago Cubs. And I think a lot of people expected me to be like Harry. I'm as far away from Harry Carey as you could possibly be. And people also forget that that's a divided baseball town. So you have half the population that's going to hate you no matter what you do because they're White Sox fans. Luckily, though, I worked with Steve Stone. He was a wonderful mentor. He was one of my best friends. He taught me a lot about how to survive those rough waters. And ultimately, the team won that year. They went to the wild card game in 98. So it was a wonderful entree for me to understanding the history of the Cubs, Chicago baseball, trying to fulfill a legacy, trying to be my own person, because ultimately, as you know, that's the name of the game. If I went on the air and tried to be Skip Carey or Harry Carey, it would have been professional suicide.
Okay, and your father was there, too. Your grandfather, your father. Ultimately, did you leave the Cubs because it was a better opportunity now with the Atlanta Braves, or it was just too much of a burden over time?
Well, it was a better opportunity. I'd been there 7 years in Chicago, and they had offered me a contract extension. My agent at the time, Lonnie Cooper, had a deal in my contract which allowed me, the Cubs had to notify me at a certain date whether I was coming back or not. They notified me, and they let an exclusive window expire, and there were a couple of other teams that were interested in bringing me into the fold, and one of them was the Braves. And I think the Braves kind of envisioned the same thing when they were owned by TBS. Come in, serve an apprenticeship, work with your dad. When your dad decides to move over to radio or step back, we have a natural lip replacement. And I was told, we want you to come and be the broadcaster here for the next 30 years. Fantastic. All of that worked out, except TBS sold the team and things changed a little bit. But it's worked out really well. I work with Joe Simpson. He's a great friend. He's a wonderful partner. My first major league team was the Braves in 91. It's home. And remarkably, Howard, when I left to go to the Cubs, all of the same people that were in charge at TBS were there when I came back in 2005. And that just doesn't happen in this business. So it was a natural fit. I'm really happy. It was a better opportunity. Yeah, the World Series for the Cubs would have been great.
Yeah.
But I think I've sort of carved out my own kind of niche in Atlanta, following in with my dad and all that stuff. And I have no regrets whatsoever.
All right, you've seen baseball over a long period of time. Neither one of us is 25 years old, so
right.
We've seen a lot of baseball.
Right.
What has changed? Because over time, and I talk to the former players, and it's different. But what, in your eyes, has changed?
Well, several things. I think money. I mean, obviously, it's a rich man's game now. The players are extremely well compensated, and I begrudge them none of that. As a result, the interaction between players and fans isn't what it used to be. You know, kids would hang out in the lobbies of the hotel to get Hank Aaron's autograph. Now they hang out there to go sell the autograph, which, you know, it's a cottage industry. I get it. What I don't like what's happening in the game is I think that in our quest to get everything right, we're taking a lot of the soul out of the game. You know, replay, I understand, but I think it's become perverted. Every call was not supposed to be replayed. The intention was never to get every single call right because you can't. There's a human element involved in it. The, shall we say, sterilization of the contact and what made the game such a joy to watch. It's right. Tough game played by tough men. We're taking some of that out. And I don't want to see anybody get hurt, but unfortunately that's part of the game. I'm missing managers' arguments. I'm missing the crowd getting riled up when guys like Bobby Cox would come out or Dallas Green would do his thing. So I think the sterilization and the homogenization of it is a little tough. I'd like to see baseball realign geographically and economically to change it up a little bit so that teams like the Tampa Bay Rays and the Pittsburgh Pirates have an even better shot to be competitive than they are now. But it's still the greatest game. The players are better now than they've ever been. They are great athletes. I don't know that they're better baseball players, and I think that's maybe the biggest difference. Guys 30, 40 years ago played baseball. These guys are superhuman athletes who are applying that athleticism to a sport instead of the sport determining their athleticism.
Kind of what I read into what you just said, fundamentals are kind of lost. Guys hitting cutoff man, guys hitting behind runners because they're worried about making an out when it comes to a contract.
Strikeouts.
Yeah.
I mean, guys today, you know, the sabermetrics guys say strikeouts are just another out. I couldn't disagree more. And it inherently wrecks the beauty of the game. Look, we're playing a game now where there are really three outcomes: walk, home run, or strikeout. And it's in some ways really depressing the game because it's not as exciting. And I know Rob Manfred, the commissioner, takes a lot of heat because he keeps harping on time of game and pace of game. But there's so much dead time that we're missing out on the action of the game. And use this example. The 1960 World Series, Game 7, the Mazeroski game.
Remember.
It was a 10-9 game, right?
Yep.
You know how many people struck out in that game?
No.
Zero. Not a single man
really?
Struck out in a Game 7 of the World Series with 19 runs scored. And that's what the inherent beauty of the game is. When the ball's in play and there's action taking place, it's athletic poetry. When it's walk, strikeout, homer, you know, you get that fleeting instant of home run. But after that, it's like, okay, now we got to wait till the next, you know, round of home runs come. So I'd like to see baseball revert back to being baseball again instead of a home run derby. That's just one man's opinion.
So is the time of game the biggest problem with why people are maybe, I don't want to say getting turned off, because there's still a lot of people that watch baseball, but you know what I'm trying to...
There are two audiences.
Right.
The audience that comes to the ballpark could care less about time or pace of game. They're paying their good hard-earned money. They want to be entertained for 2 or 3 hours and have fun. I get that. But for the people who are watching the games at home, it's a really tough, long slog. I mean, you watch the playoff games. We were at a four-hour World Series game that didn't end until 1 o'clock in the morning last year. What does that do for your audience? So the TV audience wants faster pace. They want shorter commercial breaks. They want action. They want to be entertained when they're sitting on their couch. But when it's ball four, strikeout, home run every inning, that's a really, really tough sell for a lot of people. So time of game isn't the issue. Nobody complains about being at the ballpark for 4 hours. Certainly not me. We get paid to be here.
But television audience.
But television people, yeah, I think so. And we're part of the problem. Commercials. I mean, that's a big part of the timing and pacing of the game. But pace of game is the most important thing. If we can get the ball in play more, it'll be a much more entertaining
All right. And another part of that, Odubel Herrera was timed as an average of close to 32 seconds between pitches, which is ridiculous. Does the rule, and I think the rule's in place of 20 seconds, do they have to enforce it to try to keep the action?
Why shouldn't they?
Yeah.
We have millions of laws in our society that we don't enforce, and look at what happens. You know, unfortunately, the umpires are going to be placed in an untenable position because they don't want to be in the middle of an argument with a player 4 times a night because he doesn't want to follow the rules. You could fix it really simple. Throw the ball. Strike one. The guy throw it over his head to the screen. Strike two. That'll fix the problem. If the guy doesn't want to adjust, then that's on him. But yeah, if we would just apply the rules as they are stated in the books and give the umpires the power to enforce them and have their backing, I think a lot of that stuff would go away.
You know, I don't know what players are in Atlanta. I mean, you have some good, obviously some very good players. But I saw great home run hitters, and I want to leave Barry Bonds out of the context because there's other guys that did it, only because of my personal feeling about what he did. Mm-hmm. But home run hitters can choke up on a bat to make contact. Is that another part of the game that's lost? Guys are just worried about hitting home runs, so they believe by choking up they're not going
to
get there?
Well, it's funny to me. People talked about we need to eliminate the shift, right? Remember you heard that discussion
yes.
two off seasons ago? Whatever happened to a hitter making an adjustment and hitting the ball the other way so that they can't shift on you? Baseball, we hear it all the time. You got to adjust pitch by pitch, at bat by at bat, batter by batter. All of a sudden, we're saying it's okay for a hitter just to stand in there and be a brain-dead slugger, to use a crazy term, and just wail away and expect a different result. That's a definition of insanity. It makes no sense to me. Really good hitters are the guy that are going to say, you're going to give me that hole? Okay, base hit. Then they won't shift. That'll take it away. It's really very simple, but we overcomplicate it by trying to legislate things that should be second nature to guys at this level.
Ron Darling, who was, as we both know, was a pitcher, mm-hmm. and when guys throw at people for flipping bats and doing all the other things, he said, I probably threw at 40 to 50 people in my career, but I hit them when I threw at them. Are these guys, is this just kind of what the term we use is false hustle, just throwing it over their head and behind?
I never played, so I want to be careful. I don't.
You don't have to be careful. You're with me.
No, I mean, I don't presume to know what those guys' intentions are, but if you don't want to see a guy flip the bat, get him out. It's really, really simple. Don't groove a fastball where he's going to hit it. Don't make the mistake. I personally think that watching the WBC, for example, is fantastic. I love the Venezuelan crowds and the Colombian yeah. crowds going crazy. They have the drums and the conga lines and all that crazy stuff. It's entertainment. It's entertaining to see those people get into it. I think people love and can hear that electricity and that excitement through the TV or in person. I think sometimes, we're all just sort of wrapped up in the, well, that's the way the game is supposed to play and the unwritten rules stuff. No, let's play the game with some joy and some happiness and fun. It is a game. It is a very big business. It is a very serious business. But that doesn't mean you can't let your hair down and have a little fun from time to time.
Now, why can't, and there's probably a few answers, baseball be, and I'll say like NFL football. NFL schedule comes out, mm-hmm. and the whole world stops. There's two-hour shows on a schedule, and the teams aren't even set yet. Why can't baseball reach what I think is that level?
Well, I think they do. I think if you look at the attendance numbers, baseball's had record attendance. People are in love with the game. I think what baseball's problem is that, as I said earlier about realignment or changing
right.
the schedule, which is coming, we've done a really bad job of exposing our fans to all the best players. We have the two leagues. We have the history of American and National Leagues. We've sort of chipped away at that with interleague play. But we have this unbalanced schedule where you face the teams from the West every third year. Well, what sense does it make for fans in Philadelphia to not see Mike Trout either in person every other year or on TV every year? He's a local guy.
Right.
He's one of the best players in the game. He's maybe one of the best young players in the history of the game. But because of the quirks and the traditions and the histories of our game, the superstars in the other league aren't seen often enough, which is killing your audience. I think that's got to change. I know that Rob Manfred's very serious about that. There's going to be a whole new schedule maker next year, much more favorable TV matchups to get the stars on the weekends and all that kind of stuff. But I think that on one hand, baseball's great strength is its unbelievable tradition. Baseball's biggest weakness is it's sometimes imprisoned by that tradition, and we've got to adapt. If we don't adapt, it's going to be very, very tough, I think, to keep the 18 to 34-year-old fan loving this sport 15, 20 years from now.
It seems like the Braves got to be a better team with not a lot of bad years. I don't know how many you had. You know better than mm-hmm. I, but I know there was some bad ones. But it seems like they're a better team now. What did they do where if the Phillies wanted to kind of, and it's going to be at least a couple of years, wanted to go in that same direction?
Well, I think the Braves and Phillies are on parallel paths. You know the Philly situation far better than I do, but looking at it from the outside, I credit Ruben Amaro for doing what he tried to do. They won.
How about that?
They won a World Series, and they tried with that core group to win a second one. It didn't work. No one in their right mind could have predicted that Roy Halladay was going to break. No one could have predicted that Cliff Lee was going to break. If those guys hadn't broken and you still had Cole Hamels, I think it's a pretty safe bet that the Phillies would have had a really good chance to raise a second banner during that era. Both the Braves and Phillies are doing the same thing. They have said, we're not going to be very good. We're going to rebuild our farm systems. We are going to have a steady pipeline of talent that's going to be gushing, not trickling. And we'll take our lumps now. And in a couple of years, if we draft well, if we sign well, and if we develop well, then they'll have a team that's not only going to be good for the interim, but it has a chance to be good for a long, long period of time. I think the Braves and Phillies, as I said, are within a step of each other as far as that process is taking place. It's not easy. It's not fun watching 95 losses every year. But if you look at the process and you've made a plan and you stick with it and you trust that process, you have to believe that it's going to work. And if it doesn't, you're going to have new players, new people, a new process, and a new plan.
Chip Carey, now Chip Carey said this, you, Chip Carey, gave Ruben Amaro credit in this town, and I liked Ruben because I think he did some good things, but you get killed in this town if you even mention that he did some good things.
You know, and that's the nature of the business. You know, and the other thing I think that fans need to remember is the job he did when he knew he wasn't coming back. The players he got back for Cole Hamels, yes, and the like has really set up this franchise very well. So, look, it's easy to armchair quarterback. It's easy to second guess. And, again, I'm not from Philadelphia. I don't know the ins and outs of everything that happened here. I respect the fact that they tried to win another one. It just didn't happen. Some of those same things get said about the Atlanta Braves. They only won one World Championship during their 14-year playoff run. Well, ask the Chicago Cubs how hard it is to win only one championship. It took them over a century to do it.
Great point. Thanks, Chip.
Great to see you, man.
No, great to see you.
All best. Be brilliant.
No, thanks. Okay. No, you'd be brilliant. One thing that was fascinating. I was watching that game with the Pirates as a little boy.
It is really hard to believe that he had zero relationship with his grandfather, and his grandfather didn't even know him. I whether there's family problems or not, I am absolutely blown away. And Chip, I mean, obviously the baseball stuff is interesting to talk to play-by-play guys and see what they think about baseball and see how they think the game is being played. You know, people complain about a lot of things about the game of baseball, and there are things to complain about. But I am absolutely, totally fascinated with the lack of relationship. And his grandfather has passed away, so he will never, never in his life had a relationship with his grandfather, which is kind of sad. And yet, he became extremely successful, and I would have to say one of the top play-by-play announcers in baseball. But a situation with Pete Rose, and I want to get into this. Pete Rose is allowed to do, with permission of baseball, functions at Major League Baseball parks now. He did one with the Cincinnati Reds, and they retired his number. And he's going to do one with the Phillies in August. And without Pete Rose, the Phillies would probably have not won the World Series in 1980. But what is really fascinating, now you've seen Pete Rose during the playoffs for a Fox when they do baseball games. But you may, and I didn't even think about it, and you may not have thought about it either. Where their position is set up for the pregame and the postgame is out either on the sidelines, in the stands, in the outfield, wherever it may be. It is not in the broadcast booth of the press box. Do you know that baseball will not allow Pete Rose in a broadcast booth in Major League Baseball? Now, how ridiculous is that? We've got guys that druggies and break the rules with drugs, suspended for a year. Guys come back from crimes. Hey, was this a crime? It was a violation of Major League Baseball to bet baseball. I still don't believe he bet on his games, and there was no findings to say that he bet on his games. But it's over. It's done with. He should be in the Hall of Fame, and I don't think he'll ever get there because I think baseball's so arrogant about that fact. Just let people vote, and if they vote him in, fine. If they don't vote him in, then that's too bad. But there's so many records of his, and he'll never have his record broken of the all-time hits leader. Never. Obviously, he should be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. But if you don't want him to work for a team, then you don't have him work for a team. And I'm okay with that. But to not allow him in the broadcast booth, because that broadcast booth is in the press box, he's not allowed in the press box, so he's not allowed in the broadcast booth. I mean, how petty and how ridiculous, really ridiculous, is Major League Baseball. That is absolutely a joke. It's a joke. that he's not allowed to be there during a baseball game in the press box, in the broadcast booth, in the press box. I don't know if that'll ever change. I think Pete adds some good insight. He's certainly better than Alex Rodriguez. He adds some really good insight, and I think it's ridiculous that he's not there. All right, let's talk about the Phillies. This team, at the point we did this, well, they're not going to be a good team this year anyway. They're not going to play 500 baseball, and they've got issues. I thought they would be a better team this year than last year. However, I didn't think they were going to have a better record because I thought the division was better. I didn't realize Genmar Gomez was not my cup of tea as a closer, and I never thought he was going to be a good closer. But I didn't think that almost the entire bullpen would implode, and they are terrible. But the Phillies have issues with their offense. Their offense is just terrible, and there's two players that will not be here. I would bet anything that two of those players, first of all, if you think about this, just think about this. How many players from the starting eight of the Phillies as we are here today will be with the Phillies in a couple of years? I think at most of the starting eight, at most there'll be three. There will be Cesar Hernandez, the second baseman. I think Freddie Galvis will be there because I think J.P. Crawford has just been so overrated as a shortstop. So I think Freddie Galvis will be here. And I think Altair will be here. And you're taking a leap because it's still a short sampling of what he has done. We know that Michael Saunders won't be here. And there's no question that Michael Saunders won't be here. And playing center field in the future, I think, will be Aaron Altair. I am done with Odubel Herrera. Absolutely flat out done with Odubel Herrera. Pete McCannon said recently that he thinks by the end of the year he'll hit 290. I don't think he's going to hit 290. I don't know if his approach is good enough. At least he got mad in the most recent homestand after an at-bat and slammed his helmet down after he was out at first base on a terrible swing. But I just don't think – I think maybe the contract could have been a mistake because he's got 5 years at $5 million a year. Maybe there's no real desire there. But I just don't think he's a good hitter. I think he's an okay fielder. He takes some interesting routes to the ball, but he's got some speed. I don't think he's a good base runner. I don't think he's a smart base runner. But his offense – is just pathetic. He will not be here in 2 years. The Phillies tried to it was a fishing expedition to see if there were teams interested in Odubel Herrera in the last offseason. They got almost no offers, and the offers were embarrassing and ridiculous. But I don't think Odubel Herrera would be here. But I would be fine if Pete McCannon sat him down for a week and didn't play him. I would be fine with that. But I just don't think he is a player of the Phillies' future. Another player who has gotten way too much hype when he came up was Mikel Franco. Mikel Franco, there is a problem here because as much as you tell him to try to shorten his swing, to go the other way, to adjust, and he's so far off the plate he can't hit the outside pitch, and he swings for home runs every time. But here's the problem with Mikel Franco. He is eligible for arbitration at the end of the year. What makes money in arbitration, and this is the sad part, what makes money in arbitration, and this is what's the problem with baseball and contracts, is home runs and games played. Strikeouts don't really work against you when they try to figure out the money that you're worth in arbitration. If he has 25 home runs and plays 135 to 140 games, he's going to get big-time money. Big-time money, maybe $8 to $10 million. He will at least get $8. I think it's more likely he gets $10. If he gets 30 home runs, he definitely will get $10 million. And that's what he's playing for. He's playing for home runs. He's not playing to be a better ball player. He's not playing to be a better hitter. And by the way, he's an average fielder. He's not an above-average defensive player. But he just swings for home runs all the time. I've had it with him. even though the Phillies don't have enough players, and there's not enough in the minor leagues either, and people have to understand that, and I'm going to explain that in a second. Just play whoever you have. Just play Brock Stassi. Play anybody. Play Brock Stassi in the outfield and put Altair in center field. Play Blanco at third base. I don't care who you play. I don't care what you do. But these guys have got to understand that they won't play. Now, I hear the cries and the screams and all this nonsense from people. Oh, you got to bring guys up for them from the minors. You got to do something. You got to show people. First of all, there's only one guy in the minors that might have a chance right now to be successful in the major leagues. As I say right now, in the future, probably more so, and that's Hoskins. But he plays first base. And Tommy Joseph started to hit a little bit, so you want to give Tommy Joseph an opportunity, and you don't want to bring up a player who's not going to play. And Hoskins is really the only guy. They have a second baseman named Kinnery, but you got to remember, when you bring somebody up, you got to take somebody off the roster. And what the Phillies would like to do, and they're not going anywhere this year, so there's no reason to just get crazy and rush with things, is they have to get rid of players, so you just don't get rid of a player in for nothing. Michael Saunders, you hope he catches a little bit of fire and they can trade him at the deadline. Either way, they've got to move him. Whatever you get from Michael Saunders, you got to move him at the trade deadline and create some space in that roster, even though there's not many players in the minors. And then the same thing with Howie Kendrick, who's been hurt most of the beginning part of this season. They want to try to trade Howie Kendrick, too. And I would move him, too, just to try to create some space for on a roster to bring people up. And Kinnery is not even on the 40-man roster, so he's still got some time that he's going to be in the minor leagues, I would think, all season. But you just don't bring people up from the minor leagues because there's not room to put them on the major league roster, and people should have to understand that. Patience is a virtue. The Phillies are not going to be good for 2 years, and there's nothing they can do about it. But after 2018, this season and after next season, they will go after free agents. And I would be surprised. Now, forget about Mike Trout. That's another thing you got to forget about, because his contract's not up until after 2020. And because of that, the Angels are not going to trade him. And it defeats the purpose of the Phillies. If he came up after 2018, they'd go hard after him. But I believe they're going to go really, really, really hard after Bryce Harper. And I believe they're going to go hard after Machado. And in the case of Machado, he struggled a little bit the first half of the year, but he's a player. And Matt Klentak and McPhail both know, Andy McPhail, both know, because they were with Baltimore when Machado was with the Orioles. So don't be surprised if they go after Machado. And the third baseman for Colorado is a pretty good player too. So there'll be some good players, and that's why I think Franco's got to be gone. Either Machado, the third baseman for Colorado, his name slips my mind at this moment, are really, really good players, and they are clearly better, and they are free agents that the Phillies have to target, and they will go after free agents after the 2018 season. Why sign them now or after this season when you're going to waste a year? And those are the players that I believe that the Phillies will probably target if they haven't targeted already. And a final comment about the NBA. And again, when you listen to this, I don't know what's, we know that the Cleveland Cavaliers are going to beat the Boston Celtics. We do know that. But LeBron James has got to stop whining. And I know I get on LeBron. And just understand this. All the people that want to say he's the best of all time, the greatest of all time, he's not better than Michael Jordan. That's number one. Somebody sent me a tweet at Howard Eskin, and they said, players that have scored, Michael Jordan and LeBron James, 15 points or less in a playoff game. LeBron James has done it 6 times, scored 15 points or less in a playoff game. Michael Jordan has never scored 15 or less in a playoff game. And for LeBron, in that game 3, to not score a point in the fourth quarter, I understand he can have a bad game. But somehow, don't you have to get to the foul line? Don't you have to score? And then he's so stinking, friggin' insecure. He's so insecure about himself. He gets on a reporter and who asked him that question, what happened? Well, you're only here for losses. You notice that, LeBron? Just stop it. But I'm going to give you the Mount Rushmore of NBA players. And LeBron James is not on the Mount Rushmore of players. That's four, by the way, in case you missed that. It is Wilt Chamberlain and Michael Jordan. But I'll give Michael Jordan number one. But it doesn't even matter who's number one, two, three, and four. It's Michael Jordan. It's Wilt Chamberlain. It's Magic Johnson. And it's Larry Bird. Those are the players on the Mount Rushmore of players in the NBA. And Kobe Bryant is fifth. And I don't know that I would put Tim Duncan at six, but Charles Barkley has put Tim Duncan at six. He doesn't even have LeBron James in the top six of all-time NBA players. So LeBron is too insecure. He's too much about himself. Get over it. Is he a great player? Sure, he's a great player. I'll never take that away from him. But stop with all this nonsense that he's greater than Michael Jordan. And one final note. Hey, listen, the lottery party was a great party at Xfinity Live in Philadelphia for those people listening outside the city. 3,300 people there. I thought it was ridiculous, but it was funny when they raised a banner memorializing Sam Hinkie. The Sixers, another group of people, and I think I know who it was. I think it was probably the CEO, but they asked Xfinity Live to take down the banner. So after less than 2 days, the banner in Xfinity Live came down. It should have stayed up there for at least a couple of weeks. I mean, a joke's a joke. Have a good time. I think it's ridiculous. I think it's totally ridiculous that the banner even went up. But I'm all for fun, too. But for the Sixers to be that paranoid and they don't want the banner up there and ask Xfinity Live, which is a Comcast company, which is not a Sixers company, to take it down, I think is a joke. It's a total joke. Get over it. Hey, listen, I don't think Sam Hinkie was anything but a fraud, anything but running a Ponzi scheme. But you built him up and you told everybody how great he was, and now you're bailing out of it because he's not, and you knew it all along. But let people have some fun. Let the banner up there for a little while at least. All right. Hopefully you enjoyed it. We'll be back next week with The Howard Eskin Podcast. That's how you can find it on iTunes. The Howard Eskin Podcast. Hope you enjoyed episode number 7. We'll be back again at you again next week.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.